Blog Talk Radio.
This land is mine. God gave this land to me. This brave and ancient land to me. And when the morning sun reveals her hills and plains, then I see a land where children can run free. So take my hand, this land with me, and walk this lovely land with me. Though I am just a man, when you are by my side, with the help of God, I know I can be strong.
Well, good evening and welcome to what is now part three of our attempt to have a Shabbat program. For those who are listening, whether you're listening via archive or live, we see a lot of people listening on their telephones here this evening. We made a valiant attempt to have a show last night on two different occasions, and Blog Talk Radio was not cooperative, but it appears to be working now, and we are delighted to be with you. It's Kirk and I here this evening. JB was instrumental in getting this set up for this evening.
Thank you, JB.
If I sound a little different, I told Kirk before the show began, I had a very unusual day. Everyone that's read any of these books and listened to the program knows that I am anti-political. I wouldn't go as far to say I was apolitical, because apolitical would mean I'm just not political. I'm anti-political. And yet today I spent 4 hours with the governor of the U.S. Virgin Islands. And I had requested the meeting. The purpose is that I was witnessing things in the community that were contrary to everyone's interest, and I wanted to bring them to the governor's attention and to see if, in fact, things could be done to improve the relationships between people that were working in the community, trying to build a better community, and those who were making it difficult for them to succeed. As it turns out, we hit it off. We spent 4 hours together, and we spoke at length about COVID, the country's response to COVID, to fiat currency and the destruction of our economy, on what governors around the country have done that have been so devastating to the country, to the dishonesty of the news media, to the problems of Black Lives Matter, to racism as it exists and doesn't exist in the midst thereof. It was really an extraordinary experience, where we ended up exchanging cell phone numbers and are committed to working together to just benefit the community as a whole. Now, when Iowa says he wants us to walk away from our country, he doesn't want us to be political, to advocate political figures. The governor, we had such a wonderful discussion. He brought his wife, called his wife from home and said, "You come in. I want you to be part of this discussion." And she came in, and he mentioned Trump. And this, we'll give you an example. And she was really anti-Trump, you know. And her husband said, "You know, dear, listen, we agree on many things with Donald Trump. You know, of course, he's an African-American gentleman, very distinguished, very articulate, right man." And of course, I wouldn't say he's quite liberal, because he isn't. He's is a very pragmatic, pro-business individual. Understands mm-hmm. the relationship between business and the quality of life within the community and the value of work. And so, he, by the way, was the first governor to say there is no chance whatsoever I'm going to shut down the economy again or deprive people of their liberty. I'm not going to deprive people of their opportunity to work.
Good for him.
It is not productive. It did not work, and it's the wrong thing to do, and I am not going to do it again. And I told him, I said, when I read that, I applauded him, that there's a governor with character and backbone. But his wife came in, he mentioned something about Trump, and she just, ripped him, and his wife is charming. But I made the comment, I said, I want to side with your husband on this. I think that Donald Trump's a narcissist. I think he's says a lot of things that are really stupid. But it doesn't mean that everything he says is stupid. And for example, what your husband's talking about is that Trump did not impose a national response to COVID. What he did is come up with national guidelines. And the governor said, and it's national guidelines, with exception of being late to the party with masks, was exactly what we implemented here. And it was based on the best data we had. And we implemented it here. And every state has access to that. It's a darn good plan. The reason that the president didn't mandate a national response is because the U.S. Constitution grants the authority to do things that aren't expressly granted to the federal government. To states. And he mm-hmm. recognized that we were in a better position to make decisions at the local level than which should be imposed on the national level. It was all about states' rights. He says he's done a lousy job of communicating that. But what he did is he empowered us. He gave us the power and the responsibility to serve our people. And that gives you the difference between this idea of walking away from politics, saying, I'm not going to support Donald Trump. I think he's not a good man. But that doesn't mean that everything he says is bad. There are many things he says that are good, and I want him to be successful. I don't wish him evil. And that's the kind of approach I took to this meeting. That's why I wanted to have it, is to see, can we do things that are practical that make the lives better of the people who are living here, and found a very, very receptive ear, and an interesting day. I want to go to the news because we, as a nation, as a people, have lost perspective on what is moral, what is right. Adam and Chawa never ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The first story is out of Pakistan. It says a United States citizen was on trial for blasphemy, and he'd been shot dead while appearing in court. Tahir Ahmed Nassim, 47, died on Wednesday in Peshawar after a member of the public just walked into the courtroom and opened fire right in front of the judge and killed him. And this article says that it's the latest act of violence connected to the controversial blasphemy legislation. It's not controversial. There's nothing controversial about Pakistan's blasphemy legislation. Blasphemy legislation, if you say anything that is considered incompatible with the Quran, Muhammad, or Islam, you're going to be thrown into a hellish prison, and they're going to kill you. That's not controversial. It's repulsive. It's uncivilized. But we call it controversial. Where is our character that we can't recognize when something is just wrong?
Mm-hmm. Or disgusting.
Disgusting.
How disgusting,
but then here,
do you have to be?
Yes.
Before somebody says it.
So the U.S. State Department said that its officials were shocked, saddened, and outraged by Nassim's death. What in the hell is wrong with you? No, you ought not be shocked, saddened, and outraged by his death. They were going to kill him. You ought to be saddened, shocked, and outraged that the U.S. citizen was on trial to me charges.
Mm-hmm.
You ought to be disgusted that a country that you sell weapons to does that to its citizens and to anyone who says anything that's contrary to their demonic religion. That's what ought to shock you, that he was standing trial. Not that someone out of the public killed him. Someone out of the public acting badly is a random act. The government having a law where the justice system is doing this kind of thing, that's not random. That's the kind of thing we ought to be condemning.
Don't we still give them about $11 billion a year?
Billions, yes. And
yeah.
Both monetary aid and weapons. Yeah, it's disgusting. There is a report that came out of the Cato National Survey this week, and it is exceedingly telling. In fact, I brought this up in my discussion with the governor. It says nearly two-thirds of Americans, 62%, say that the current political climate these days prevents them from speaking out on their political views. So they're unwilling to speak out. This particular article says the share of Americans who self-censor has risen several points. In other words, they know that they aren't free to say what they want to say, even about something that should be the ultimate in freedom of speech, which is politics. Now, this journalist stupidly says these fears cross partisan lines. Now, the most revealing part of this is that these fears are clustered in a community that has lost the right to speak. The minority, it says the majority of Democrats, 52%, so half of Democrats, 60% of independents, and almost 80% of Republicans say they have political opinions that they're afraid to share. Half of Democrats, and we're going to take the Democrats here in a moment because it's far more revealing. 60% of independents and 80% of Republicans say that their political opinions are not open to discuss. Strong liberals, they say, strong liberals, we're talking about communists here, socialist, secular, humanists, stand out, however, as the only political group who feel that they can express themselves. 58% of liberals feel that they can say what they believe. Why? Because political correctness, because the media, because academia now says that it's hateful to say anything other than to promote the agenda of socialist secular humanism. The reason that the media is embracing Black Lives Matter is that it's at its heart a communist organization. They want to recast the nation in their socialist secular mindset. And so what you have now is the realization that you can no longer speak freely, that you are not free to express a view that would be conservative as it relates to the imposition of government. But you can only speak if you want overreaching government interference. Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm.
80% of conservatives, 80% say they're not free to share their political views.
When I was in school, I told you this story, I think, once before, that I was talking with the head of the education department, and we were talking about this issue. And he was adamant about having people on both sides of all the discussions, both conservative and liberal, if you like, discussing that and openly discussing it. And he said, that's how you find the truth, is by everybody participating in those conversations. And when you used to say those things about the school system being such a shutdown place because of political correctness, I used to say, well, that was not my experience. I believed you, but it was not my experience. But lately, I have talked to an awful lot of people in the UC systems in California. Man, you don't say nothing around these people if it ain't the party line.
No, that's right.
You say nothing around that. And there,
right.
These people have told me this and go, we just don't even discuss it. Don't. And I said some things, and they said, don't you ever go there and say this, this, and this. They will just get all on you. So I'm going, wow. Okay, well, it would scare me, but geez. You're right.
Sometimes it's important to tell the truth, even when it's not politically correct. In fact, it's always important to tell the truth, especially when it's not politically correct. Amnesty International says that the children of Yazidi religious minority, that was in northern Iraq, who have suffered brutal captivity at the hands of the Islamic State, are now suffering severe physical and mental problems. Almost 2,000 of the 7,000 who were seized and enslaved survived the enslavement. 2,000 of the 7,000 who were seized, women and girls, who were gang raped, who were sold as sex slaves. 2,000 of them survived. And what's happened is that in an Islamic country, a woman who has been raped is shamed. A woman who is raped is punished where the man who raped her is not. And so these children have come back with children that they did not want. They were forced to do this. And they're being shunned by their own community. So they're, after having been sex slaves, gang raped scores of times a day, such that it's just the horror of it. It's stunning to me. By these animals calling themselves fundamentalist Muslims, they're being rejected by their own community. The boys have come back without limbs, having arms cut off. The girls, many of them, coming back with the children. And they're trying to commit suicide. And so the article says that the boys who lost limbs, the girls who were raped, all suffering greatly. They were all enslaved by these IS fighters. And that, like, the community says, listen, I want to tell everyone in the world, please accept us. Please accept our children. We didn't want to have a baby from these people. We were forced to do so. Now, these women, we were enslaved. They were tortured. They were subjected to the most repulsive forms of sexual violence. And this was at the hands of fundamentalist Muslims. And no one in the West condemned Islam. Against that story, I want to share something about that just shows how far we have fallen in our ability to think, and how we have become to the point where we believe lies as if they were true. Actress and comedian Tiffany Haddish said that she has avoided having children because she's afraid the police will hunt them down and kill them. Now, she's not outspoken against Islam, Miss Haddish, for turning these young girls into sex slaves, cutting the arms off of young boys. I'm not speaking out against that. No. Not speaking out against the blasphemy laws in Pakistan and the inability to speak openly. No. She's of the myth that if she has a child, the police, because that child is black, will hunt that child down like it's an animal and then kill it.
Where does that come from?
I was reading a a report from an academician who is just repulsed at Black Lives Matter. He's a black academician. And he says, you know, this notion that there is this institutionalized racism in America is the furthest from the truth. America is the least racist nation on earth. The academic said the same thing, conclusion I've come to. And this idea that that we're somehow a white supremacist nation that has deliberately held blacks down is not only untrue, but in the left, it has been promoted such that if you don't agree with that, if you don't advance what is clearly untrue, then you're marginalized and ostracized. He says, so it's become a cause celeb. It has become a mandate in academia and the media to promote the myth. I'm going to speak at the end of this news review on the consequence, where we have fallen in this regard. But speaking of fall, we talked about on this program the day that governors began to deprive U.S. citizens against the Constitution of their livelihoods and liberty, that the reaction to COVID-19 worldwide was going to be far worse than the disease. And it turns out the disease, while bad, has a mortality rate of somewhere around half of 1%. By almost any standard, it's not a pandemic. Half of 1% is the mortality rate. And of those who have tested positive, it's less than 1% of Americans, for example, have tested positive. Very, very small percentage of people who have contracted the disease, and the mortality rate on the disease is about half of 1%. But yet our reaction to it, we destroyed most countries in the world, literally destroyed their currencies. They destroyed their economies. They destroyed people's character, turning them from productive to dependent. And I said, the consequence of this is unprecedented. Well, here are the numbers. The U.S. economy contracted at a 32.9% annual rate from April through June. It's the largest drop in the history of the nation, worse than anything the nation experienced in the Great Depression. A 33% decline. You know, if growth slows from 3% to 2%, we have a problem.
Sure, yeah.
If growth were to stagnate and we had 1% growth over a quarter, we would be really worried about what has happened.
Mm-hmm.
To have a 1% contraction is almost unheard of. 33% contraction. That's not a slowing of the rate of increase. That is, we lost a third of our economy. That's just a stunning number. And it's, quite frankly, irrecoverable. The world will never return to what it was. 20 million jobs were lost in America. They simply vanished. Against this backdrop, John MacArthur, oh, he is Grace Community Church, one of the large mega churches in California. You know John MacArthur.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Oh, yeah. John MacArthur. He says that the church has a biblical obligation to comply. Well, according to God, there is no church. Bible mm-hmm. is a corruption of Babel, which means to confuse. And it is based on Ba-bel, which is with the Lord.
Satan.
Right. And the Lord is Satan. Mm-hmm. So he went and says, when officials, this is his own words, restrict church attendance to a certain number, it deprives me of my income. No, he didn't say that, but that's what he was saying. church attendance to a certain number they attempt to impose restrictions in principle that makes it impossible for the saints to gather as the church. Saints.
Mm-hmm.
Saints. You know, saints are dead people. Religious dead people.
Yeah.
The saints. Yeah. When officials prohibit singing in worship services. Can you imagine a God
never
so,
to be done.
So insecure
lame.
He wants to be worshipped? A God so lame that he wants his creation to worship him? Don't you ever, John, ever just take a step back and to say, wow, that's really stupid. Why would I want to worship a God that wants me to worship him? And if God doesn't want me to worship him, why am I worshiping him? I mean, for a God to create an inferior being to worship him makes him so insecure, so superficial, he's not worth knowing.
True.
Then he writes, it is with these mandates, it's impossible for the people of God. By the way, the people of God aren't the church.
No.
God's people are Yisrael.
Mm-hmm.
Full stop. You should read that book that you call the Bible. It's really clear. God's people are Yisrael, not a Gentile church. John, read the damn book. The people of God have to obey the commandments. Now,
no.
Is he talking about the commandments of the ten that Yah etched in stones? Oh, no. Have to obey the commandments of Ephesians 5:19, of Colossians 3:16.
Yeah.
We have to obey the commandments of our Savior.
Paul.
The plague of death. And by the way, John, since Paul wrote that the Old Testament was a cruel taskmaster that one had to obey and that it couldn't save, and that Paul replaced that with the gospel of grace, where all you have to do to believe, how can there be a commandment in Ephesians and Colossians? John?
Good question.
The mandated distancing of believers is condemned in what is commanded in Romans 6:16, 1 Corinthians 16:20, 2 Corinthians 13:12, where a little later on it says that Paul admits that he's demon-possessed, and 1 Thessalonians 5:26. Every verse he cited, without exception, Paul. Ephesians, Colossians, Romans, 1 and 2 Corinthians, and Thessalonians. Couldn't find anything, John, could you, in the Torah? In the prophets, in the Psalms? Oh, and John, pray tell, John, why didn't you quote from Romans chapter 13, where it tells you to submit to your government, and that all governments are appointed by God, and that all governments do good? Why didn't you cite Romans 13, John?
You're good.
Oh, idiots. So, there's Black Lives Matter. There was a mural, street mural, outside the Trump Tower. A street mural, that's. They took the street, and they, facing Trump Tower, they defaced the street with their graffiti, and wrote the Black Lives Matter in just huge print. Well, it was vandalized. Now, the Black Lives Matter painting in the street, public street, with their declaration, which is a racist declaration, that wasn't vandalizing. Now, last time I thought graffiti was vandalizing state property. So some people wanted to paint over it, which would be restoring the property. That would be considered a good thing, and the vandalization would be writing Black Lives Matter in front of Trump Tower. Well, the police arrested the four people who had put blue paint on their hands, who were trying to simply remove it. And they call them the vandals. So President Trump actually wrote that Black Lives Matter is a symbol of hate. It's true, it is. And simply and sharply criticized New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio in a tweet for denigrating this luxury avenue. Well, the mayor responded. Here's what he wrote. "Here's what you don't understand," in all capitals, screaming, "built Fifth Avenue and so much of this nation. Your luxury came from their labor, for which they have never been justly compensated. We are honoring them. The fact that you see it as denigrating your street is the definition of racism." Well, let me help you out here, Bill de Blasio. Just a little help here. What you don't understand is that black people didn't build Fifth Avenue. As a matter of fact, slavery was illegal at the time that the Union was formed. So before America became a nation, the northern colonies had all outlawed slavery. The slaves that had existed, and very, very few, in the northern states prior to the 1770s were almost all domestic household workers. They cooked meals, they cleaned homes. They didn't build things. They did not build Fifth Avenue. They did not build Fifth Avenue. You lied. They did not build much of the most of the nation. Not even close. In the north, they built very little. As I said, they were domestic workers. In the south, they harvested cotton and tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
And the Spanish colonies of Florida, they harvested sugar cane as well, but that wasn't part of the U.S. colonies. That's what they did. They weren't building America. They did not build much of this nation. It's just an outright lie. And if you got a lie to make your point, you don't have a point. Slavery is a horrible institution, no question about it.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons I hate Rome is that Rome was one of the worst nations in the history of the world at enslaving people. But there's a reason that Yahweh doesn't condemn slavery. What he does is he put in a mandate that all slaves have to be freed every 50 years. All slaves have to be freed. And he had very specific instructions that you could not abuse slaves. And the reason that Yahweh didn't condemn slavery, but instead taught us that we should never abuse slaves and that ultimately they have to be freed, is because not to be a slave would be dead. That's just the fact of the matter. That people, unfortunately, are vicious and they war with one another. Slaves are the product of two kingdoms, two groups of people warring with one another. And there's, and Islam, for example, it was the way they financed the growth of Islam was through slavery. And you have, when you war with a group of people, you can steal their property. And once you've stolen their property, you have two choices with the people. You kill them or you enslave them.
Yeah, otherwise, what would you do with them? They would come out and get
right.
you.
Right, and if you left them there, they'd come back and they'd take your property back.
So fight them again.
There's only two choices. You enslave them or you kill them. Now, I'm not justifying what they did, what Muhammad did and what these kings did and empires did was repulsive. That's why Yahweh speaks against them, I cannot stand them. We ought not be glorifying them. But that is the reality. If you were not a slave, you were dead. And the same thing is true with the slaves that were brought to the Americas. They were captured by fellow Africans who warred with one another. And Once they had more slaves than they could handle, they when they fought with one another for territory, they just killed everybody. And when Muslims became successful in northern Africa with their raids, Islam is all about enslaving people. That's why it means Islam means submission. And you know, Abdallah means slave to Allah. They said, hey, you know, don't kill them. They have value. Let's sell them as slaves. And so all of the Africans that were brought to the New World would have been killed as opposed to live. Just the truth. Slavery is a horrible institution, but that's the truth. As for the rest of what he built, your luxury came from their labor. No. There isn't a single black person who created the luxury that we benefit from. This happened a very long time ago, 200 years ago. There is nobody that lives 200 years. There is nobody who can say, you know, the fact that you have a luxury condominium on Fifth Avenue is the result of the labor of these black people, of their labor. No. That is factually untrue. It's not even remotely true, for which they have never been justly compensated. They have never been. That is to say that what happened 200 years ago in a system that was pervasive around the world for 5,800 years of recorded history, that the descendants of the blacks here, who have been compensated, by the way, that's why what we call affirmative action and welfare and all manner of systems where blacks are 40% beneficiaries of wealth redistribution versus about 11% of Caucasians, and that they have been compensated. And beyond that, they didn't perform any of this labor. Speak the truth. If you can't tell the truth, you don't have anything worth saying. And he says, we're honoring them. No, you're not. And the fact that Trump sees graffiti in his street as denigrating is not the definition of racism. You know, what we have to recognize is that to be discerning, to be discriminating in terms of information is to be thoughtful. And that to be a racist is to judge people based on their skin culture, not their skin color, not their culture. And then to automatically ascribe negative attitudes and attributes to people strictly based on their skin color. I was having a discussion with Leah a couple of days ago. It was a fairly heated discussion where I do not think that ethnicity has any significant influence over the difference between what happens in the African American community and what happens in a Hispanic community, for example. That the behavioral differences, good and bad, are driven by culture. And that there are many influences of culture of which ethnicity is not one. And culture is influenced by religion, by politics, by work ethic, by social customs in different places. It's impacted strongly by environment, climate. There are so many things that influence culture, but race is not one of them. And so we really ought to understand the difference in these two and never judge anyone by their ethnicity, but instead judge them by their behaviors, by their ideas, by their words, by what they do and what they say. I came to the conclusion that I think is fairly profound this past week, and I'm going to share it with you, and may get a lot of pushback on this, but Black Lives Matter is a conspiracy. After pouring trillions of dollars into building the great society out of ending poverty into affirmative action, into all manner of government support for minorities, conditions are worse than ever in the inner cities, in these communities. Mm-hmm. So what do you do? With wealth distribution, with the great society, with affirmative action, with political correctness, with it all, it's failed miserably. It failed. Because as a community, the community lacked the will to succeed. Not everyone, but as a community. As a community, they lacked the discipline to learn. Even though the doors of the universities were thrown open, they lacked the character to work. They lacked the concern for their children to guide them. So what now? Blame themselves? Admit that the progressive politics was regressive? That it failed? No. What do? We blame others for our failures. And then we spread lies as if they were true. The one common denominator amongst all conspiracy advocates is that they're unsatisfied with their lives, and rather than taking responsibility, they blame others.
Blame someone.
The government is trying to poison me and control my mind with chemtrails, with vaccines. They're trying to control my life with the stooges acting out Boston Marathon bombing, the Pulse nightclub, the Shady Hook, Sandy Hook school shooting. They're all staged by the government trying to control our lives. 9/11 was an inside job by the U.S. government to control our lives. No, rubbish. Stop blaming other people. Well, what's the ultimate conspiracy? Blame the Jews. Yeah. And so Black Lives Matter is a conspiracy. The community has made horrible choices. And as a community, the community has failed. Blacks kill blacks. Blacks rob blacks. Blacks deprive other blacks of opportunity. And they're unwilling to accept responsibility or accountability. And now they have the progressive liberals judging everyone else, condemning everyone else, pretending that this is a white supremacist nation, holding the blacks down, and it needs to be destroyed so that the blacks can rise. Yeah, that's like the proletariat and the bourgeoisie and the communist uprisings in China and Russia. Oh, look at the luxury life that they have. If they that 1% were just out of the way, you would live like that. Pretty soon, everyone is in poverty. And that's exactly what would happen here. It is a conspiracy. Go ahead, Kirk.
No, I was going to say, why is it so easily sold to people who are supposedly educated?
Because
why does
they
it grow in a culture,
anymore,
a university culture, where people have PhDs and are supposed to know something?
They're indoctrinated. Why did the woman we talked to last week about the woman, and this was a big part of my discussion with the governor today, that giving incentives, tax incentives, for example, for a business to come to a place where you get, say, 50% of the tax revenue you give up. So it's you're gaining 50% of a large stream of tax revenue. versus a 0% of whatever. 0% of something is zero.
Mm-hmm.
And 50% of something, if that something is significant, like you brought a business here, well, that's
right.
Meaningful. And they can't figure it out.
Well, what is it they don't understand? Also, what y'all didn't mention in that discussion was that people don't understand how money flows. You know, once you pay those people, they spend it in your community. And if they're smart enough not to give it to giant stores and they give it to the locals, you know, and do their business at the local grocery stores or whatever, that money flows and that flows and they continue and they spend that on this and they spend that on that. And everybody's empowered to – money circulates. And so that's what makes the economy
the governor was saying, he says the truth about the Virgin Islands is that 16 people pay 80% of the overall tax.
Wow. That's amazing.
And yet those who are paying nothing, bellyache, can say that that they aren't paying their fair share. That we have indoctrinated people. They have no understanding for how things work for economics. In fact, he said, every time I try to do something that's good for this community economically, unfortunately, my people don't have the wherewithal to understand it. And I think that's could be said of almost anywhere in the United States. It's, we have dumb people down where they can no longer think. And they're just not educated enough to be able to process information in a thoughtful, rational, informed way.
Wow.
So that is our fundamental problem. That's the problem that we cannot solve. There is no solution to that problem. That's why God is so anti-government and so anti-religion. All right. I want to return and conclude the 23rd Ms. Moore song. It ends with an amazing crescendo that, and I really do not know how we were able to miss this. By the way, I'm told that cannot connect. Check your internet connection and try again. I'm concerned that we're flat out not broadcasting.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, this is good stuff here.
Yeah, I'm told we're not broadcasting, so I'm trying to reconnect now, and we'll see. So those who are listening on the phone probably can hear us, but in terms of the listening
recording?
Online, I think. Pardon?
Is the recording good? Is it still
recording? On the phone, or so you can hear. So I don't know. Leah just walked in and said we are broadcasting. So even though it says reconnecting, who knows? Okay. Mizmor Psalm 23:5 reads, "My cup overflows with abundance." Now, this was right after he said, "You have anointed my head with oil." So in context, it's important to understand what this cup is all about. Yahweh is using dashen, which means to cover. It means to prepare. And its root is to grow. And it's his head with oil, which is symbolic of the Spirit. Yahweh instructed men to anoint Dod as the Messiah according to his specific instructions. But Yahweh himself anointed Dod, coming from above to cover him with the Spirit. The Spirit, he said, came upon him in abundance and never left him. The Spirit is what caused Dod to look so perfect in God's eyes. It's what caused Dod to be so courageous, so bold, a man of character, a man of astonishing intellect and wisdom. And it is the fact that the vessel that is his soul overflows with abundance. Why? Because Yahweh specifically said he placed his Spirit on Dod in an overflowing, in an abundant fashion, giving him tremendous power. So my cup, the vessel, which is filled with my spirit, overflows with an abundance. And this is the word, Ra'aya, means that Yahweh has saturated me. Yahweh is satisfying, and that Yahweh has come to my aid and is helping me. Now, we as people like to think of ourselves as serving God, but in actuality, it's God that serves us. You know, we want to, in religious ceremonies, lift God up in praise, and that's impossible. But he is very, very effective at lifting us up, which is the entire purpose of what a father does to a child. So my cup overflows with abundance. Did you look at either of these words?
I did. You have the cup was in the sense that it's a hand with an increase, and then there's a protective thorn at the end of it. It's the third word, and that Meshemek is symbolic of the one that captured the lamb when Abraham and Yitzhak were on the mountain, on Mount Moriah. So, but it does say it's a hand. So you get a protection symbol there. You get a giant increase there, as well as the hand that pours this onto him or to anoints him. Then there's a two-letter root, which is the hand and the kaf and the shemek, which means just to cover and to count, which is interesting, and to appoint. It is the seat, like a seat of power. It is to. It also is a cup that holds and conceals and covers something. So it is. But I think of it more in terms of holding something very valuable. Mm-hmm. And then the whichever way you pronounce it, is you have a observant head looking at an increase being held up. My Yahweh's hand reaching down. And the last one is a feminine word with the H at the end, the hey, which is a person engaged in the walk toward in the covenant, reaching up and saying, behold. It's a feminine noun. It means to saturation, is abundance, and great abundance, overflowing with abundance, if you like. The verb, rawa, is to satisfy and to satiate, to soak one. And so you have also the two-letter root is the rosh and the hay, which means not only the soak, but interesting enough, it means lion, which is the symbol of dode. And there's a word that's right next to it in where they had two hays, rahaha. And it means the flowing of words, which I thought was quite interesting because we are, after all, talking about Dode, and no one flowed word more than he did other than Yahweh himself. There's all a whole lot of symbols in that would strengthen and reinforce what we're saying.
Right. Your theory has been that most Hebrew letters are directional. The Rosh is probably the most directional of all Hebrew letters. That means that the letter is either going left to right or right to left. Like the foot is pointed in
left
a direction.
Right, yeah.
Now you have some letters that do not have direction, like the hay. The hay is symmetrical. Looking up, reaching up, standing up. The legs are equidistant apart. The arms are equidistant apart. But the LF, the ram's head is pointed in a direction. The bay
has a three-quarter turn to the left.
The entrance of the home on the left side. So what you learn, and you know, the staff leans from right to left. So there are letters that have direction. And what you learn is that if the direction of a letter looks away from a letter that's in Yahweh's name, that word has negative connotations. And if the letters look towards the letters in Yahweh's name, the word has positive connotations. And if there are no letters in Yahweh's name that are to the, or there's no direction in the letter, then you can't use the theory. But any time that there's a directional letter, you determine good or bad if it's looking towards or away from. The Rosh is looking at three letters in Yahweh's name. Yahweh's name, while there's four letters in it, one's repeated. All of those letters, all three of those letters are there. The Wa, the Yod, and the He. And the Rosh, all of them.
Amazing, so, isn't it?
Yes. So, and it even has Yah's name in it. And so it is Yah providing this abundance of help, of benefit. Yes, John, the truth is that God wants to help us, not the other way around. So, this goes from there to surely act, indeed exclusively, goodness, tov. And it's interesting, act is a very uncommon word in Hebrew. Because if you wanted to say just indeed, truly, surely, you would, it's key. And it's key starts, you know, probably 20% of Hebrew sentences. Very, very common. Act, very uncommon. So, indeed.
It's impacted with a lot of stuff.
Yes.
It's a lot of stuff in this, surely.
Yeah. Yes. Indeed, exclusively. Goodness. Hope. That which is beneficial. That which is prosperous, honorable, generous, festive, beautiful, pleasing, healing. And unfailing love and enduring mercy. Chesed, devotion, favor, will pursue me all the days of my life. The conclusion that Dode realized with Yahweh having anointed him, Yahweh having helped him abundantly, is the result is all things good, beneficial, prosperous, honorable, generous, pleasing, beautiful, along with unfailing love, enduring kindness, pursue him. He doesn't have to go to God and say, I need your mercy. No, they're pursuing.
Mercy pursues him.
Why? Because it's God pursuing us. It's God that wants to initiate the relationship with us. It's God who wants to act favorably to us. All we have to do is get out of the way. You know, stop being religious. Stop being political. Stop being obstinate. Start thinking. Start being open. Start being receptive. And God will pursue us with mercy and love all the days of my life.
I was just looking at the letters dictate that very statement in the first word, surely. You have an Aleph, which is Yah, or an authority's hand, in this case, Yahweh's hand, pursuing or helping, if you like, the nun. It's an Aleph Kaf nun.
Right.
And it means to be in a sure manner, to be firm in something. It is a guarantee, like his promise is the, wow. I mean, and that's just in the word surely.
And if Yahweh is going to pursue us with mercy, unfailing love, and enduring kindness, why do we need a new
Paul's a liar. Yeah. Well, what more can you get?
Right. Yeah. And so this is the most amazing thing. And I don't know how I missed it. I guess we're just so programmed to, when I was a Christian, to transfer everything that God said about David to Jesus.
Yeah. To Jesus.
So I must have thought, well, God's speaking to Jesus. But the funny thing about that is, can you tell me how many times Jesus' name is written in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms?
Zero.
How many times is the correct name, Yosha, written?
Zero.
How many times does it say talk about the church that he's going to establish.
Once again, not to sound like a broken record, zero.
Huh. So, there isn't a single prophecy that speaks of Jesus, of Yosha, or of the church? Not one?
Not one.
How many are there times is Dode's name mentioned specifically in God's testimony?
I believe it's over 1,000 at least.
That is correct. So, do you think that God is so stupid, doesn't know the name Dode from Yosha?
Well, you've got to be.
So the man that he called his son, the man that he anointed as his Messiah, the man that he called and named to be king,
the man that he chose,
whose name is Dode, when he's talking about this other fella, that he uses Dode's name instead. I don't know. What's the other guy's name? Come on, folks. Never once.
I think the reason you belabor this like this, and it is, it's because it is so straightforward that this is Dode, and it so changes our thought pattern now, especially those of us that came out of the Christian frame. It is just like it opened the door to everything. It's like, wow.
Yes.
This is just the most phenomenal thing we've done since his name.
Yosha played an extraordinarily important role.
We can't walk through
the Passover lamb. He is the Passover lamb.
Without him. Yeah.
He's the one thing that no one wants to acknowledge. Religious Jews and Christians, neither want to acknowledge that he was the Passover lamb. No one can figure out amongst Christians that if Jews actually killed Jesus, that they ought to be thankful because the Passover lamb doesn't do anybody any good unless the Passover lamb is sacrificed. So if they did kill him, which they didn't, but if they even brought him forward to be sacrificed,
that was
served
a positive
an
thing.
Enormously important function, and they ought to be thanked. Now, if the Jews, of course, killed God, you ought to be worshiping the Jews. Think it through.
That's true, too.
Okay, so here's the concluding thought. And all of those Christians carrying it around in their Bibles, and they can't process this information. Or all of those Orthodox Jews that spend all day being religious. Got their religious little get-up. They got their little curly Q on the side of their head. You know, their little black hats. You know, they have their women shave their heads. I mean, they have 1,000 reasons not to do anything on the Shabbat. I mean, they can't go in an elevator because they can't push the button. They can't do squat. They got a law for everything, and yet they're saying that they're searching for the return, or not the return, for their Messiah. And right here in the most famous poem ever written, what does it say? Why are you searching, Jews? When it says, and I will return. And I will return, being brought back to restore Yahweh's family and home forever. Full stop. That line alone, which is the concluding line of the most famous poem, the most famous bit of prose in the history of humankind, 23rd Psalm. And it states emphatically, there's no second coming of Jesus. Dode is returning. There is no new covenant and a church. John. Dode is coming to restore Yahweh's family and home. God. John. It's Yahweh. Yahweh's family, his people, who happen to be Yisrael, John, we're not replaced by your Gentile church because Dode is restoring them and bringing them back forever. John, why don't you read the damn book that you lug around? Why don't you sometime cite the 23rd Psalm as opposed to the poison pen of Paul? And I will return, bringing back to restore Yahweh's family home forever. Shub means return. Shub means bring back. Shub means to restore. Shub means to reappear. It's to reappear specifically at a homecoming. And Beth means family and home.
Mm-hmm.
And the a literal definition of the last word, which is la orek yomim, would be for an unlimited length of days.
Yes. You know what it's so, related to also? Its first mention is the length of the ark regarding the Noah's Ark, which is symbolic of the Ark of the Covenant, which is, contains eight people, the sign of eternity.
Yes.
And so if you're looking for, because you could be confused by some of the lexicons because it just talks about a length of time, or an arak for the verb is a long duration of time. However, when you associate it as Yahweh did with the Ark of the Covenant and all those symbols, then you cannot come up with anything that is other than eternity. So we're talking about the eternal length of time. Yes. And it's,
so if you're wondering why I rewrote Observations, and the first two volumes of five of Observations is now available for purchase at Amazon, both in a Kindle book. I think it's 99 cents for the Kindle book and about 14 bucks for the each of the first two volumes of Observations, and there's three more to follow. And why we now I'm returning and rewriting yada yada, it's because of this. It's just because of this. Yahweh is as clear as words allow that he's returning with Dode. That Dode is the one who is involved in a second coming. That it's Dode's responsibility for restoring Yahweh's family home. Which means that Dode is the Savior. Dode is the King. Dode is the Shepherd. Dode is the one through whom Yahweh chose to work. Dode is quite simply the most important person in the history of the world. And what we need to realize is that Yahweh chose a Messiah and anointed him three times. It's Dode. Yahweh chose a king. It's Dode. Yahweh chose a shepherd. It's Dode. Yahweh made a choice. And the only person that he is expressly committed to saying, I chose him. He is my chosen one. Is Dode. Dode is the author of the Psalms. He's the author of the Mashal Proverbs. More is said about him than any other individual. You know, as much as we make a big to-do about Moshe, and Moshe was an extraordinary individual, a great liberator, a great prophet, an extraordinary man.
Mm-hmm.
God has far more to say about Dode. Far more. And as much as Moshe's speeches, which are recorded in Devarim, Deuteronomy, are insightful and profound. Almost everything that Moshe says, because Moshe's words are not recorded in the Barbara Sheath in the beginning. It's God's testimony, Jehovah's testimony. He's a scribe.
Mm-hmm.
In Exodus and Shemoth names, while Moshe has a speaking role, it isn't a good one. You know, he's reluctant. He's got every excuse under the sun. And so it's again Yahweh speaking to us. Moshe is a conduit. And the same thing would be true with Kara, with Leviticus,
mm-hmm.
where God lays out his plan. And the same thing is true with within the wilderness, with Numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And the same, but it's not true with the body, where these are Moshe's interpretation. It's so Yahweh to say, mm-hmm. all right, I can't have Moshe explain creation. I can't have Moshe explain the dialogue that I had with Abraham or with Noah or with Adam. I can't have Moshe explain what happened in Babel. There are things I cannot do through Moshe. But after I've spent all this time with Moshe, the proper thing to do, because I want to work through creation, not apart from creation, is to have Moshe explain in his own words mm-hmm. what I have shared. And Moshe does a brilliant job in Devarim. I mean, quite honestly, I think I actually like Moshe's presentation of the 10 statements better than Yahweh's. Is that me? I hope Yah's not too mad at me for saying that. But,
no, I don't think.
You know, I've read both, and while there's aspects that
relate.
Are essentially identical, the places where we needed more explanation, like honoring your mother and father, and on the real symbolism of the seventh day, Moshe does a really nice job. He ad-libs and throws in some insights that I think are really important. So Moshe does a wonderful job. However, he doesn't hold a candle to Dod. Dod's contribution in terms of life and lyrics are much greater than Moshe's. Yeah, Moshe was not the greatest of the prophets. He was the greatest of the prophets at that time, and God did some marvelous things with him. The greatest prophet is Dod. And it is this fundamental shift in our understanding that Dod is the embodiment of the covenant, that Dod is the example that we can follow, that Dod's words are words we can live by. And that this emphasis away from Dod and towards the Christian Jesus has so misdirected God's intent, so inconsistent with God's intent, that it is essential that we set the record straight. That's why we're rewriting all of these books. It's a huge undertaking, but it's all for this reason, the conclusion of Mizmor Psalm 23. Now, Kirk, we said, you know what we're going to mm-hmm. do is we're going to take back and rejoin in observations that would be, we left off in what would now be Volume 3, Chapter 3, Seat of Honor. And son of a gun,
yeah.
It's just the most amazing way that the 23rd Psalm flows right into the 4th chapter of Yeshayah Isaiah.
Agreed.
It's just like these things always belong together, and they should be read one after the other. So after Yahweh in the 3rd chapter of Yeshayah is condemning religion and religious dress-up. You know, I just can't stand religion dress-up. It's true that God hates religious dress-up, even more than I do. And then 4:1, which I think really is the conclusion of the 3rd chapter, because there aren't chapters, that was a later designation, reads, nevertheless, let us be called by your name, with it upon us, to transfer and withdraw our reproach as a result of our taunting insults and blasphemous slurs, even our harmful statements and lowly status. There was a dig in Jerusalem. I think it was Mike Bellotti that said this to me just the other day. A rock pile there, and underneath the rock pile, they found one of the largest government complexes.
I saw that. That was very good.
Yeah, and that government complex was really interesting. It was during the time of Hezekiah, and shows, of course, that the story of Hezekiah is true. All of the insignias are all there, and all the insignias on everything within the storehouse all read the same. Belongs to the king. Lamalach, for the king. And so what God, and the place is just filled with pagan idols. And so the people brought their foodstuffs, they brought their taxes, they brought their everything of value, like their idols, and it was stamped for the king, for the king, for the king. Which is why Yahweh said, if you choose to have a king, what he's going to do is take from you.
Take your stuff.
Right. Yeah. This didn't say the stuff wasn't marked for the people. It didn't say for Yahweh. It didn't say for the orphans. It was all for the king. It shows just how repulsive Yisrael had been, even at a time when there was a brief awakening under Hezekiah for the king. But it shows that the God's depiction of his people in this place is precisely accurate. So pretty destructive for the fake Estinian myth, is it not?
Once again.
Yahweh will indeed withdraw the reproach of his people, Yisrael and Yahudim. With them coming to their senses and ceasing to insult and taunt God with their absurd religious rhetoric and their absurd religious outfits. When this occurs, Yahweh will return to camp out with his children on Zion. And what follows is this marvelous presentation of Sukkah. It reads, in this day, which is his day, living vegetation will sprout and thrive, branching out and growing, Shemach, for Yahweh. Now, the reason that I just thought this was so interesting, and from this point we actually chased this rabbit through a lot of different holes, is Shemach. Shemach is a term that is a title that is applied to Dod throughout the prophets. He is the branch. And so in this day, which is his day, the branch will be for Yahweh. Now, there is, the term can also be translated, living vegetation will sprout and thrive, branching out and growing. And so you can look at this as one of two ways, both of which I think are true. One is that God's going to restore the earth to the conditions that were found in the Garden of Eden, that all of that religious paraphernalia, pagan idols that were found and the religious dress up, it all goes away. All trappings of religion and politics. And then God's going to restore the earth so that it looks like the Garden of Eden, living vegetation. Or you can say, well, Shemach is used as a title to describe Dod's title. He is the main branch of the tree of lives. In this day, which is his day, the branch will be for Yahweh. I think both are true. And it shall be accordingly beautiful and splendorous, spread out in an attractive and desirable manner, reaching out in an honorable way, and will therefore approach as a glorious manifestation, kavod, drawing near as an abundantly significant, dignified, and rewarding presence, along with the majestic and eminently wonderful La Gaon, impressive and lofty, fruitful offspring, peri, productive harvest of the land, Ha'eretz. Also, gloriously attractive in shining appearance as the remnant of the survivors of Yisrael and Yehuda. Yeshaya 4:2. You know, here we come right out of 23rd Psalm, and Dod is returning to restore the family of Yah, mm-hmm. and we open the first, the beginning of Yeshaya 4, and what do we have? We have Yahweh restoring the branch, it growing and manifesting itself, sprouting and thriving. And that God's saying that this is so beautiful. It's just this glorious manifestation, majestic, wonderful, contributing to a marvelous harvest of offspring, production, productive in the lives of people, gloriously attractive and shining in their appearance as the remnant of the survivors of Yisrael and Yehuda. God was coming home. Dod is returning to restore the family. God is saying, yes, Yisrael and Yahudah will be restored. They will be brilliant again. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. It's what God has always wanted. A lot of wonderful adjectives in this one, Kirk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah, you have thriving vegetation, thriving, branching out, growing. Shemak, that's a great term, isn't it?
Shemak. Well, there's four aspects I found of that. There's the sprout, of course, and the growth, and then what grows and where it grew. And then you find it written in terms of the process of growth that's what I would think of in a humanistic concept. And then it says it's also used, the word is used in a future role related to the vine of Dod and his reign as being Sadak. That's in I didn't cite the thing, but I found it. It's there. And that's from Shemak, the verb to spring up and to make to grow again, which is once again the house of Yah, which is found in 2 Samuel 23:5. So it refers
to
Dod's house.
The branch of Yahweh growing, mm-hmm. reaching out, supporting life. That's what Dod mm-hmm. does. That's what his lyrics do.
Yes. And the covenant family grows. Jacob's, the house of Jacob, you know, ruled by Dod.
And here we are with the next verb, Yahweh's name, by the way, all to approach Yahweh, for Yahweh. It shall be, Haya. It shall exist. Law, accordingly, approaching this. And then so many of these marvelous adjectives. Beautiful and splendorous, Shebi, spreading out in an attractive and desirable manner, in an honorable way. And then kavod.
Yes, beautiful.
Glorious, significant, dignified, rewarding. Gagon, majestic, eminent, wonderful, impressive, lofty. Its root, ga'a, to rise up, to be lifted up, to grow. Fruitful, productive. Peri. And he's not speaking of Washington, D.C. or the United States. He's not speaking of London or the U.K. He's not speaking of Paris or France. He's not speaking of Mecca. Not speaking of any place other than the land of Yisrael. And the people are not going. People, not in a church. God knows what Yisrael means. He knows what Yehuda means. And so upon this glorious return, the survivors are not the survivors of the church. The survivors are Yisrael and Yehuda. If God wanted to say, and he's quite effective in his prophecy, if God wanted to say that upon this marvelous return, there'll be a great celebration of the Gentile church, a church, my people, he would have said that, wouldn't he?
Certainly. He knows how.
But he didn't, did he?
No, sir.
What he said was, Yisrael and Yehuda, there's no room for a Christian church. They're not God's people. God's not returning for his church. He's returning for Yisrael and Yehuda. And by the remnant of them, it's those that are left that Gentiles didn't kill. There's a lot to be learned by that statement. The next one reads, then it will come to pass that he who remains, this is, you know, the last of the last days. Man has all but annihilated himself. It's been nuclear war. It's been a terrible Islamic invasion of Israel. There's been an asteroid strike. There's been a huge tsunami that resulted related to it. There's been complete economic collapse. There has been the imposition of a one-world monetary and economic and political system. Israel has been, and Jews have been scapegoated and had conspiracies plotted against them, all manner of horrible things. You know, this rise of Black Lives Matter is so anti-Semitic that it's central to all the things that are working against God's people. And so it will come to pass that those who remain, the few, those who survive in Zion, which would make God a Zionist.
Yes.
Along with the remnant spared, the remainder, those who are left behind in Jerusalem will be called set apart. They're not being called saints. They're being called set apart.
Kodesh.
Set apart from
always.
What?
From the rest of the world. Sure. To him.
Yeah, set apart from the world of politics, set apart from the world of religion, set apart from the world of protests, set apart from the world of militarization and patriotism, set apart to him. They will be called set apart because Yahweh was set apart. The Spirit is set apart. The Torah is set apart. The land is set apart. Yisrael is set apart. Yehuda is set apart. They're all set apart from the family of man unto the family of God. They will be called set apart, for all who approach him will be written and inscribed in the book of lives. In Jerusalem, not in the Vatican, not in Mecca, not in Washington, in Jerusalem. This is the last of the last days, the last act. And God is returning to his people, Yisrael and Yehuda, in Zion, which is the heart of Jerusalem. Yehuda, Yisrael. All of the claims of replacement theology are therefore wrong. He's returning for his people, and it's his people whose names are written in the book of lives. How in the world, Kirk, did replacement theology and Christianity grow out of this when they're carrying around the poison pill for their religion? How is it possible that you could carry this around? the conclusion of the 23rd Psalm and this statement, and build a religion based on replacement theology, on claiming for your wannabe God, not a wannabe God, it's just not true because Yoshua didn't want to be a God, but no. Claiming on your God, claiming for your God all the promises that were made to this man, claiming for your church all the promises that God made to these people. And then you read the last acts of the last days when Yahweh is returning. He's returning to his people and names them explicitly as Yisrael and Yehudah. And says he's coming back to Zion, signposts along the way. And it's his people's names who survived all of this that will have their names written in the Book of Lives, which, by the way, is also kept in Jerusalem.
You know, just to pound another nail in it, the word be'et is the root word is a be and a tall, and it's a bet and a tall, which is the house of Jacob. It is
yes.
A Zion marker. It's the house of Zion.
Yeah.
It's the house of Jacob. I mean,
yes.
He says, "I will dwell forever in the house in the Be'et."
Yes.
B-T root. B-Y-T. Sorry. But the root word. So I mean, you can't miss it. No, any which way you look. That's the only reason I do it the other way. You know, I look through the letters more so. You cannot miss this stuff. You put it everywhere anyone would look if you were looking.
God is clear. He has said that he made a promise to Abraham that he would, that he said he was going to keep. And he did. And he will. And he is, through his prophets, he has said it in every possible way that he's returning to restore his relationship with his people. It is the day of reconciliations. What is he reconciling? Yisrael and Yehudah together and to him. And that's why it's called the day of reconciliations, plural. There's no mention of a church. There's no mention of a synagogue. There's no mention of rabbis. There's no mention of Orthodox Judaism. As a matter of fact, it's Orthodox Judaism that was condemned in the previous chapters.
Yes, a religious dress-up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's returning for Yisrael and Yehudah and the remnant who survive. And it's those who have listened to Dod's call to bring them home, who have finally come to accept Yahweh, who acknowledge him by name, who finally come to understand who he is, what he's offering, and what he expects in return, and have accepted him and acted upon what he's offering. And this is what God has promised to do. And from God's point of view, now, mind you, the world is in shambles. The world has all but been destroyed. It's likely that greater than 90% of the world's population is dead.
It's gone. Sure.
And the chosen people has been decimated. We know that it's at least two-thirds of them that are gone.
Two-thirds, yeah.
And maybe more. And yet, Yahweh saying, this is glorious. It's wonderful. It's the realization that God celebrates family. If we had a child that ran away from home, that you know got caught up with the wrong crowd, and that child beleaguered. In fact, let's say that child took five or six siblings with him, and they got in the wrong crowd and they all got themselves killed except one. And one of them comes back and says, "Dad, you were right. I shouldn't have rejected the teaching that you gave me. You gave me good advice. And I'm back. I want to be part of the family again. Will you take me back? I want to come back home." And what's the dad going to do? He's going to celebrate. What a wonderful moment. You know, You know, I know what it's like to have a child walk away for foolish reasons. And if my child came and say, you know, I went back home. You were right, Dad. I want to be part of the family again. I'll celebrate
my happy day. My happy day.
Yes. And Yahweh has promised that this day will occur for his people, Israel and Yehudah. And he is going to celebrate it. This is the thing that the religious miss, because you know the Roman Catholic Church wants to consider themselves right because of the numbers of people, 1.5 billion of them. You know, Muslims say, well, we've got the fastest growing religion. There's another 1.5 billion of them. And because there's so many of them, they must be right. And God's view is no. I didn't tell you that there would be millions of people here, or billions of people, or that I'm so impressed by the vast numbers of people that I'm embracing in the end. And peoples from all over the world, of all different ethnicities and cultures, are all here, and we're all having this great party because the whole world has turned their attention to me and has accepted me. No, he's not saying that at all. He's saying exactly the opposite. That it's just Yisrael and Yehudah, which collectively represent less than two-tenths of 1% of the world.
Of 1%, yeah.
The only people that he's acknowledging here, they represent at most 0.2% of 1% of the world's population. And he's saying that even in their case, it's a tiny remnant of them who have survived. And yet he's celebrating this. Because it's never been about numbers. It's not quantity, it's quality. And the kind of relationships that Yahweh establishes in his covenant family. And that's why he is celebrating on this day. And the fact is, this door is wide open. Any of us, you know, I'm not Yisrael and Yehudah, and I'm going to be there.
Nor I.
Yes, and nor you. And we're both going to be at the party because it's an open invitation. So that's a good place for us to stop for this evening.
I think so. That's a marvelous show. I really is.
Yeah, like I said, we did record,
thank
so
you.
That part plays. So well, hopefully that what I saw was just for the chat room. I was unable to read anything in the chat room, and so maybe that message was just for the chat room. I'm glad we did this. Thank you, JB, for getting us reestablished, and thank you for those of you who came and listened on
and persevered.
The sun went down. It's the Shabbat.
But not here.
But
so you can be here.
Yes. Yeah. For you, it is still Shabbat.
The sun is still shining.
For a little post Shabbat. So thank you all, and we appreciate you joining the family as we try to share Yahweh's message to us. May Yahweh bless. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
She posted it on Shamor.